Cytiva, now with the life sciences business from Paul, is a global provider of technologies, services, and expertise to help researchers and companies protect and preserve the planet for improved human health and safety. With a rich heritage dating back hundreds of years, Cytiva brings a wealth of technical expertise and talent, a broad and deep portfolio, and exceptional service to help researchers and industry labs at every stage from source to shelf. Visit Cytiva.com to learn more.
This is the Master Brewers Podcast, brought to you by the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, a volunteer organization dedicated to continually improving the products and processes of our membership since 1887. Let's go! Master Brewers brings you interviews with the industry's best and brightest in brewing science, technology, and operations.
Calm down, I'm moving too fast.
This episode was made possible by the following sponsors.
Discover more ways to enhance flavor and maximize beer yields with Salvo. Now available in varieties like Sultana, Trident, Lotus, Calypso, Cascade, and many more. Discover how Salvo can help boost your brew at hopsteiner.com.
Berkeley Yeast, creators of diacetyl-free yeast strains. Diacetyl-free strains are bioengineered to produce the ALDC enzyme inside the yeast cell to keep diacetyl low during fermentation and after packaging. Diacetyl-free strains create the cleanest flavor profile possible, which makes them the yeast of choice for the most exacting brewer. Go to berkeleyyeast.com to read about how brewers are using diacetyl-free strains to propel their beers to the top of the podium.
Attention all brewing professionals dedicated to operational excellence. Enhance your brewing processes with Brewmax by ProLite. Our sophisticated brewing management software is designed to optimize production, ensuring the highest quality brews. Unleash the full potential of your brewing operations. Visit our website to learn more. Brewmax, empowering brewing excellence from grain to glass.
The implication or the importance of this is that it allows trans-2-nonanol to move through the process effectively undegraded. Complicates the matter because it carries it through when you normally would be removing it.
This week on the show, we take a look at barley lipids and how they impact your process and the quality of your beer.
I'm Aaron Golston, and I'm the Brewhouse and Fermenting BPM at Anheuser-Busch in Newark, New Jersey.
Aaron, I'm sure we've talked about lipids at some point during one of the last 300 plus episodes, but since we're doing a deep dive today, what are lipids and what are the different types of lipids?
So lipids are a complex class of macromolecules that are involved in a whole bunch of different plant and animal cell functions. They make up cell membranes. They're used for energy storage. They're parts of hormonal signaling pathways. So it's really hard to generalize them as like just lipids or thinking about them as oils or anything like that, because they are really complicated. But generally, they're broken down into two different categories. We kind of look at them as polar and nonpolar. And the way to think about that is, can they dissolve or partially dissolve and mix with water, or do they not?
Do you want to give us some examples of lipids that we might encounter in the beer world?
You know, an example of a nonpolar lipid would be like triacylglycerides, which are a neutral lipid that's found within the barley kernel. And it's basically three fatty acid moieties or chains that are bound to a triglyceride backbone. And those eventually get cleaved apart and turned into individual fatty acids, which can get oxidized into off flavors.
You just said barley a minute ago. Where are lipids found in the barley kernel, and what purpose do they serve there?
So this is something that I kind of like to ask people about, because it's really fun. They're found everywhere in the barley kernel. The literature loves to say that they're found, you know, they're concentrated in the embryo. And while that is true, there is a high concentration of lipids in the embryo based off of, you know, weight. But the majority of them are actually found in the bran and the endosperm, when you look at the total amount of lipids that are within like a barley kernel, about 77% of them, based on some studies, are found within the bran and the endosperm. So when you go and mill, you know, there's no way to not disrupt the lipids that exist within there, because that sometimes exists within the literature, but they're really everywhere in that barley kernel.
So are these lipids all pretty much the same as one lipid, just like any other lipid, or not so much?
No. There are a whole bunch of different types of fatty acids within the barley kernel and just in general. And specifically when we talk about, you know, barley, we're kind of really referring to linoleic acid, which is an unsaturated fatty acid, meaning it has double bonds in the long hydrocarbon chain, and those double bonds can be oxidized. And that is significant because linoleic acid is generally greater than 50% of the free fatty acids bound to those triglyceride backbones in the barley that make up the barley lipid composition.
Aaron, how do lipids get us brewers into trouble?
So starting from the triacylglycerides that exist within the bran and the embryo and the endosperm, the two ways that this kind of goes is that you either cleave the fatty acids off from the glycerol backbone by lipase activity into free fatty acids, or you oxidize them before they're cleaved and then form the free fatty acid peroxides. So you end up at the same place where you end up with these free fatty acid hydroperoxides, and from there they are either auto-oxidized by oxygen, or there's other various enzymatic pathways that end us up at trans-2-nonanol and hexanol.
So is one of those two paths typically more heavily traveled or no?
Generally speaking, the triacylglycerides lipase creating the free fatty acids, and then auto-oxidation or LOX enzymes creating the free fatty acid hydroperoxides, that is the dominant pathway. They generally, it's because there's more space for the enzymes to oxidize the fatty acids because they don't have to deal with all the other molecules getting in their way as they're floating freely within solution.
Things get a little more complicated as we look down that trans-2-nonanol pathway. Talk about some of the things that can happen.
So people often think that you just have lipids, they get oxidized, and they form trans-2-nonanol. But it's kind of weird, because I didn't really know about this until I got interested and started digging about these adducts, or what they call nonanol potential. And this is when you form trans-2-nonanol, and it binds with the amino group of proteins, peptides, or amino acids. And what this really means is that you have two compounds that are coming together to form one compound, or one single product. And the implication or the importance of this is that it allows trans-2-nonanol to move through the process effectively undegraded, or being volatilized out of the process, because it changes the chemical properties. So what would normally be evolved, or from the evolved CO2 during fermentation, you know, taken out of the wort or the fermenting beer, it stays in there now, or evaporated during the boil, for example, as well. So it complicates the matter because it carries it through when you normally would be removing it. And the same kind of thing can happen with SO2 or sulfur dioxide created during fermentation or added in the process later.
Okay, let's take a look at our brewing process and talk about how we can control some of this and make better beer. Should we start with mashing, or is there anything you want to mention in regards to malt storage or milling?
Don't mill too far in advance, because if you let it sit for a long time, it's going to collect moisture, and you know, you have the opportunity for auto-oxidation of any exposed lipids. So
what do you think too long is?
I generally don't think anything more than, you know, 8 hours would be a good idea. But I think it's going to vary depending on the brewer and the types of products that they're brewing.
All right, let's continue through the process. What do you want us to know about mashing?
So mashing is kind of like ground zero for what's happening with lipid oxidation during brewing. And what you have happening here is both enzymatic and auto-oxidation. And auto-oxidation means it's reacting with the oxygen that's in the atmosphere or it's in the wort or in the water, and the chemical reactions are proceeding, so you have an oxidized fatty acid at that point. The big considerations for anybody who's wanting to avoid lipid oxidation during mashing is keep your mashing temperature above the range that lipoxygenases and lipases are active, and make sure that your pH is in control. The lower your pH, generally speaking, the less LOX activities they're going to be, which is lipoxygenase. And then for mashing temperature, you know, keeping that above, you know, what I say is 57 degrees Celsius, or right around 60, which is that sweet spot for alpha amylase, or like the floor for alpha amylase. I would say stay above that, and that's going to give you a much better shot at minimizing the activity of lipoxygenase, because that's really active between 45 and 55 degrees Celsius.
So it's not going to knock it out completely. You're just going to have less activity.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way that you can fully prevent this from occurring unless you're brewing with loxless malt. And again, you have oxygen to contend with. Most brewers have a four masher that's on the top of their mash cooker or their mash tun. And so when you're dealing with that, you're adding oxygen as you're mashing in. And if you have an agitator, if you're agitating really hard, you might be creating a vortex, or if you have baffles on the side of your vessel, that can create eddy currents, which allows oxygen to get into the wort. And while you're at a fairly high temperature, which should decrease oxygen solubility, it doesn't stop it entirely. And so anything that you can do to make your mash more gentle, obviously without scalding anything on the sides of your vessel, is really going to be beneficial when it comes to minimizing both the enzymatic and auto-oxidation, because you're going to be decreasing the amount of oxygen in solution for all factors considered.
All right, so what happens during lautering?
So during lautering, you've obviously completed your mash off. So before you even transfer into your lauter tun, you've heated your mash up to deactivate any residual enzymes. And so once you have done this, you eliminate the potential for enzymatic oxidation. And so all we're trying to do at this point is minimize auto-oxidation in the lauter tun, because a vast majority, and I mean up to 90% of the lipids that are in the barley kernel are lost during lautering to the spent grain. So in order to prevent lipid oxidation and minimizing the amount of lipids that you carry forward into your boil, which will subsequently end up, you know, further down in the process, you want to make sure that you're minimizing oxygen inclusion. So you want to fill your lauter tun as gently as possible. And that means you should have a little bit of water under your false bottom to make sure that you have gotten most of the oxygen out. When you're filling, you want to minimize splashing. You don't want to just plow it in from the top. It would be nice to have a gentle fill low in your vessel. And then as your bed settles, to fill a little bit higher if you have multiple fill ports, or if you have little pop-ups that allow you to fill from the bottom, you know, gently filling until it gets to a place where you can go a little bit faster. So modulating the speed there to minimize oxygen getting entrained in your mash. And then when you're running off, every time you disturb the grain bed, you increase lipid extraction. So raking is obviously a natural part of our lautering regimes. So, you know, like where I work, we have our rakes on the entire lauter, and it's there to reduce the differential pressure across the bed and increase porosity. But by doing that, we increase the disruptions of the grain bed, which will inherently increase the extraction of lipids. you know, if you do something like sparging, which we all do, that will increase the amount of lipids that are extracted, especially as the pH starts to shift and your lipid to sugar ratio changes. It increases specifically as you run off. So as the matrix changes, your lipid extraction will change with that. And then another disturbance is obviously increasing your runoff flow rate, which a lot of us do as you progress further down the mash. As the viscosity decreases, you increase your draw-off rate. And obviously that's a time savings because we want to put as many through as we possibly can, but also we don't want things to sit any hotter than they have to for any longer than they need to. So all of these things, when you kind of think about them as a holistic unit, is you want to allow the grain bed to remain as undisturbed as possible outside of the natural need to rake, sparge, and increase draw flow rate. So if you have a brew that's taken, you know, 10 cuts in your ton because you're brewing with a lot of wheat, or you have done something that has included a lot of husk, or you've beaten up your grain, you might struggle with the turbidity of your wort, and a lot of that turbidity can be as a result of lipids.
All right, good to know. Just curious, any difference in oxidation if the brewer is using a mash filter?
Mash filters, as far as I recall, actually do a better job at having less lipids, that lipid removal in general. And while they're pulverizing their grain using a hammer mill, the grain bed tightens up so much that largely you're running off very clear wort. There were some papers that were done on this, but given that we're in North America and the majority of the vessels are lauter tons here, my focus was largely on that. But there are some very good papers out there talking about the mash filters.
All right, cool. Well, let's move on to the boil. What happens then?
So during the boil, obviously we're trying to evaporate water, remove volatiles, isomerize alpha acids, form some color, but we have to consider what is also happening to the lipids that have come through from the lauter and the lipid hydroperoxides that have come through from the mash. So up to 10% of the mash lipids are present in the boil or in the kettle. And a lot of those, and by a lot of those, I mean the majority of those, will be removed with the trub as the protein denatures the lipids and the protein, the denatured proteins bind together and they go out with the trub. But what happens is there's a lot of splashing during this process. The boil is a very aggressive energetically, and there is some oxygen inclusion that does occur. And so we can form non-anol potential. So any trans to non-anol that has been formed has the potential to bind other compounds during the boil. And once you form that, the non-anol potential allows the trans to non-anol to move through the process relatively unscathed. So the boil is hugely important because any way that you can minimize splashing, oxygen inclusion is going to help you, especially during filling. But it's very complicated when you start to think about it, because now we're talking about a really hot liquid that has very low oxygen solubility, but somehow we're really forming a lot of this non-anol potential, which has the potential, obviously, downstream to create a headache from a sensory standpoint for many brewers.
So is most of that occurring during kettle filling, so before you're actually up to boiling temperature?
To be honest with you, I'm not 100% certain. I've always emphasized the need for a quiet fill, as we call it, which should minimize foaming. We want to be as gentle as we can there. So, you know, if you're filling from the top of the vessel, that probably isn't helping your case. Most people fill from the bottom. So I don't think it's going to be a huge issue, but making sure that your heating elements are covered before you actually turn them on so that you don't end up with a bunch of foam, obviously is a consideration, but I don't think most people are in that spot. But, you know, pump seals can leak, et cetera, that can.
Yeah, I was going to say lauter pump seals on the way into the kettle are probably a pretty big culprit.
Yeah. We use water seals on our vessel, on our pumps, to make sure that those work, and people check those on a regular basis.
coming up.
They were having issues with the papery off note, and I'm going, okay, have you looked at your brew house? And they're like, no, but our package oxygen is really low. And then I saw how they were filling their kettle.
I'm John Bryce, and you're listening to the Master Brewers Podcast from the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. There's really only one thing that keeps this podcast going, and that's when listeners like you take the time to thank our sponsors. The next time you talk to a rep from one of these companies, be sure to thank them for their generous support.
Brewers, if you want your cans to stand out on the shelf, CanCraft is ready to be your digital printing partner. Fast, flexible, and fully custom, CanCraft digital printing promises eye-catching appeal, seam-free aluminum surfaces, and low minimum orders to fit your business needs. Whatever your budget and whatever your goals, contact CanCraft for crisp images, clear copy, and 100% recyclable materials. Learn more at CanCraftSolutions.com.
Get to know Proximity Malt. We malt superior, European-style, low-protein varieties grown close to home in Delaware and Colorado. Domestically grown, precisely malted to style. With our team of seasoned experts and two brand new malt houses, try what's really new in malt. Check us out at www.proximitymalt.com.
Are you sure you're getting the best deal? Visit the Lupulin Exchange, where you can find every hop variety, every brand, and every vendor. Compare prices, reviews, shipping speeds, reliability, and more. Over 1 million pounds shipping direct from every hop merchant and grower in the U.S. The Lupulin Exchange. One stop, all the hops.
Are you headed to Vegas for CBC? If so, please come see me at the Lupulin Exchange, booth 1281, in between YCH and John I. Haas. I'll have an awesome free t-shirt for you while supplies last, and I'd love to hear about your experiences on the exchange, what we could do better, and how I can earn more of your brewery's business. And here's what's coming up on the Master Brewers calendar. District Rocky Mountain meets April 24th at Odell Brewing Company in Fort Collins. District New York meets April 29th at Grimm Artisanal Ales in Brooklyn. District Carolina's Spring Technical Conference is May 4th at Hopfly Brewing in Charlotte. District St. Paul Minneapolis meets May 9th at Shells Brewing in New Ulm. District Northwest meets in beautiful Hood River May 10th and 11th. District St. Louis has moved their spring quarterly meeting to May 30th at Urban Chestnut. The Master Brewers Brewery Maintenance Systems course begins June 6th. It's time to save the date for the 2024 World Brewing Congress. That's August 17th through the 20th in Minneapolis. And this year, the Master Brewers Brewing and Malting Science course runs September 5th through November 8th. Check out the full calendar of events at mbaa.com for more details or to find a district meeting near you. Now back to the show. Talk about what happens on the cold side.
So right before we get there, obviously we have a hot work receiver or a whirlpool of some type of settling vessel. And we're really trying to, you know, decrease the amount of hot break that forms. Nobody wants to carry all that forward. Everybody is aware of the impact of hot break or unpredictable hot break on yeast, because it can coat the yeast, which can decrease the fermentation rate or the health of the yeast. It can cause ester formation depression, and then also it can decrease the amount of SO2 formation, which is obviously beneficial from a freshness standpoint. So we're trying to get as much trub out as we possibly can. So when you're doing that, like I mentioned, the proteins have denatured during the boil. And when you do that, you expose what's called their hydrophobic region. The proteins are folded in such a way that keeps the regions of the molecule that don't like water, don't want to interact with water, kind of hidden, so they don't actually interact with water. But when you denature a protein, that all becomes exposed. And so they're no longer soluble, they're insoluble, which you create these flocks. And the lipids, as we mentioned, are kind of nonpolar, and they don't want to be in the water either. So they see this like this hydrophobic region, and they bind to it, which encourages the removal. So denatured proteins tube is very important for lipid removal. And this can remove up to 90% of the remaining lipids that are in solution. And what's actually really interesting, when you look at TRUB has 51 times more wort. More lipids than wort. So, and when you look at those specific lipids, 70% of them are unsaturated, which means they can be oxidized. So TRUB is a hugely beneficial, like, we'll call it a sink for lipid removal. And if you don't have good TRUB removal, you're going to carry a lot of those lipids forward into the process, and it's going to impact your fermentation. Obviously, like I mentioned, it'll increase your fermentation rate by encouraging more yeast growth, which is going to shift your flavor profile around if it's inconsistent for your process. If that's how you normally run, then it's not going to change anything. But if it's not how you normally run, it will definitely cause changes in your process.
Okay, so let's say you've done a good job of limiting TRUB carryover into your fermenter. What happens next?
So I guess if you're in fermentation and you have, you know, you're adding some oxygen, right? This is actually a question I get pretty often, is that what about the oxygen that you add? Well, generally speaking, that gets consumed so quickly that it doesn't have a chance to react with any of the lipids that you do carry forward. And because it's required for the yeast membrane, they gobble that up really fast. And there have been studies that have shown there is no impact on shelf stability or freshness associated with that. But obviously we need yeast to grow. And as a part of the yeast, you know, the fermentation process, we're evolving CO2. And that creates kind of a churning effect inside the vessel, and actually does volatilize some compounds in the wort or in the green beer. And if there's any free trans 2 nonanol, that can be reduced to alcohol or reduced to alcohols, or form adducts with SO2. But any free stuff could also be volatilized out of the vessel.
Aren't lipids also consumed by yeast? I remember a famous study from years ago in which New Belgium added olive oil instead of aerating wort.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know why. I think it was Sierra Nevada, but I think, yeah, I think you're right. It was one of the larger craft brewers who did this. I believe they published a paper on it. But yes, the yeast will absolutely consume lipids that are carried over. Now, I can't say if it will be all of them, or which specific type. I'm not all up on that. But they will consume that. And this is one of the reasons, obviously, we as brewers use oxygen as a rate-limiting or growth-limiting nutrient for yeast. And so as soon as you start to increase the availability of lipids, because yeast are using oxygen to synthesize sterols and fatty acids that can be used as part of their cell membrane, if you increase the amount of lipids that get carried forward, then you all of a sudden, you get more growth, faster fermentations, and associated with that, you get the decreased ester formation, and you're going to see decreased SO2 formation. On the other side of that, if you run with a super clarified wort, you're going to see decreased yeast growth and sluggish fermentations because there's no nutrients in there. So I believe that there was somebody who actually autoclaved wort and then filtered it and then fermented it. And they saw that they were very, very slow. And it's because you've removed all the nutrients. So, or at least you've removed aspects of the lipid nutrients for the yeast. So it's really, in my mind, not about stopping you from carrying lipids forward or changing your brewing process to avoid this. It's about consistency. So your process is your process. And I am not here to say that any one person is brewing beer the wrong way. But if your process is inconsistent, you'll end up with inconsistent results. And therefore, if your lipid carryover is variable per brew because you have different settling times, your boil isn't as consistent as you want it to be, or you're disrupting your trub pile at the end variably depending on hop bill if you're substituting. That's going to all impact your fermentation profile, which is all going to impact your fermentation in general and the flavors and the output, because it's not going to be consistent.
Absolutely. And we're getting at why there's sort of this Goldilocks break content that gets carried over. There's literature that says it's bad and there are some negative impacts, but there's also literature that says, hey, you need some of this and it has benefits too. It's like everything in brewing. There's always a balance.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really about consistency. If you don't even, separate your trub and you just send that forward, and that's the way you make that brand and that brand is selling, I'm not sure I would change it. Because as soon as you start messing with it, everything else is going to start to change. But, would I recommend that you start making a beer from scratch that way? Absolutely not. So the name of the game is consistency. Are you happy with how your product is tasting, a month down the line or when you package it? How's it standing up? Are you actually getting, notes of, cardboardy, papery, or cucumbery? Are you picking up those oxidation notes? Because if you're not, then perhaps this is more informative as you're going forward to think about what you can do to improve your mash or to improve your lauter or improve your boil. But you may want to just avoid perhaps looking at what's going on in your whirlpool right now if that's not giving you issues. It's like anything, there is no one size fits all solution for it. It's really your process, which means you are the expert on it, and everything else is just information to inform you on how to make better process decisions.
All right, let's move on from fermentation and look at filtration and finished beer. I guess ideally we'd have zero lipids remaining in our finished beer, but that's probably pretty difficult to accomplish. What should most brewers expect at this point in the process?
Well, generally speaking, at this point, you should have a negligible amount of lipids in your finished beer. And we're talking over 99.5% of the lipids that were in your barley, your malt, have been removed or consumed. So there, we're talking like really low levels. But what's interesting is that some of the ones that remain, and depending on their chain length, so they can be medium or long chain, decrease foam stability. And I know we all talk about, cleaning glassware and making sure that, the dishwasher is effectively removing any residual oils and all of that. But things that we put in the beers contain these medium and long chain fatty acids, as well as some specialty malts contain these, and they can decrease the foam stability. So there's a lot of things that are happening. Yes, we would like to remove absolutely everything. Can we remove absolutely everything without basically stripping it down to a base of clear liquid with alcohol in it? Absolutely not. But it's just something to be aware of, that you can see foam stability issues associated with lipids that have been introduced from the malts. And the other thing is that you haven't seen probably any or much of the non-enol potential degrade back into trans to non-enol. So you have to contend with the fact that that's still in there. But here's the kicker. You don't actually know if it's going to degrade. Because, and they've done some interesting studies on this where they have kept it at constant temperature over a long period of time, or they have increased the temperature, and the results are variable. So it's not like just keeping it cold is going to prevent it from being released, or if it gets warm, it's going to be released. Yeah, keeping it cold is the best thing that you can do holistically for a beer from a storage perspective, including, minimizing the degradation of non-enol potential into trans to non-enol. It's not going to be the be-all, end-all if it is stored a little bit warm. There's probably other flavor degradation reactions that are going to be more impactful than just the release of trans to non-enol. And again, like I mentioned, it's not 100% that it's going to happen. So it is a bit unpredictable. But the really important thing to mention here is, and I hear this from a lot of people, is that oxygen inclusion in filtered beer and in the package has little to no impact on trans to non-null formation. So I've seen a huge emphasis put on really low TPOs, and that is an excellent practice from an oxidative degradation standpoint. Good for flavor stability. It means your process is in control. You're reproducing, you're reproducibly producing good packaged beer. And, you know, the major packaging vendors have done an excellent job of designing fillers for this purpose. Low oxygen inclusion, good, you know, evac systems or purge systems. You got your jetters, your undercover gassers, and all of that is doing a great job of minimizing oxygen inclusion. And you can get down into that sub 100 range pretty easily now, which is awesome. But that isn't going to stop you from having papery notes in your finished beer, because it's really not coming from the package. It's coming from your brew house. And that, what's crazy about that is that I had an inkling about that before I wrote this paper and before I ever started talking about this. And I was talking with a brewery, and they mentioned to me that, you know, they were having issues with the papery off note. And I'm going, okay, have you looked at your brew house? Because I was pretty certain that it didn't form in the package. And they're like, no, but our package oxygen is really low. And then I saw how they were filling their kettle. And they were filling the kettle from the top. And I'm going, oh, but I didn't know how to articulate it. And so then I spent all of COVID writing this paper so that I could then explain to them that, hey, you just need to fix your brew house and that'll go away.
Okay, so where is the low-hanging fruit? How can brewers put the biggest dent in lipid content?
So generally speaking, minimize your time between milling and mashing. That's an easy one to do for most places, but I don't think it's going to be the most bang for your buck. Really, it's going to be coming from your mash. You know, if you can mash in a grow above 60 degrees Celsius and keep your mash pH below 5.6, minimize splashing and, you know, get in and get out of your tun, or I'm sorry, of your mash cooker, then I think that's going to make a big world difference. The other thing is, and this is not something that most of us can do anything about because this is the equipment that we're given, is filling it from the bottom or making sure that you have a diverter that takes what's coming out of your foremasher and puts it down the sidewall of the vessel. And some people may be having a hard time visualizing this, but I think there's a bunch of stuff in papers. It effectively is like half of a funnel that is put underneath your foremasher that angles it towards the wall. And if you have something like this, you're obviously going to want to make sure there's a spray nozzle to clean it. Otherwise, you're going to get some funky buildup because it probably will have a shadow from your main cleaning gamma jet or spray ball. But filling it from as gently as possible is going to minimize oxygen inclusion, especially when we're dealing with the potential for the enzymatic oxidation, which is limited to the mash cookers.
Aaron, any other tips or considerations or problematic areas in breweries?
So I've seen breweries that have hop dosers, you know, a separate vessel on the side that you add your hops in, wort comes in and takes it away. A lot of the times those vessels are purged with CO2 or nitrogen to empty them, to press everything out. But I haven't seen places that have a lot of purge gas once it gets filled. And generally speaking, I get concerned around the idea of a vessel with hops filled with oxygen and then getting filled with wort and then getting taken out, which means everything that was in that vessel just went into your wort, which to me increases the risk of auto-oxidation. And so if there was a way to gently purge the hop dosers in a safe way, because purging with inert gas is great from an asphyxiation standpoint from as a human. So any way to purge those out a little bit, I think could be beneficial for the formation of auto-oxidation products with lipids. But, you know, generally speaking, I haven't seen anyone do it in practice. I do think that would be a very good way to do it overall. But the other things to consider is when you're dealing with external wort boilers, or you're transferring to your whirlpool, or while you're actually whirlpooling, minimizing the amount of shear. So whether it's the type of impeller, how fast you're recirculating, how long you're whirlpooling for, anything that you can do to minimize the shear is going to minimize the disruption of the protein flocks and decrease the amount of lipids that get carried forward, because the smaller your tube particles are, the more that are going to be carried forward, because it's going to take a longer time for them to settle.
Yeah, I've seen some small breweries where maybe they've used all these process aids and gone to great lengths to get a nice tight true pile, and then they have a single speed on their pump and just crank it, let it go for a while, and you basically just chop up all those nice flocks into tiny little bits that do the exact opposite of what you want, right?
Yeah, variable speed drives are a wonderful thing. I understand that they add cost, but they are, from a gentleness standpoint, very good. And the other thing to consider is that there are an almost immeasurably large number of impellers out there for pumps. And so making sure that you have the right type of impeller is going to also minimize the shear in general, because I've opened up the front of some of these like pump carts that you can buy from, you know, supply companies, and you sometimes see just a simple cross as the impeller. And I know that there are open impellers and semi-open impellers and closed impellers, and each one, you know, for a different purpose and a different solids amount and, you know, what have you. I'm not a pump engineer, and those guys, I can't even. They're the curves and things they say, it just makes my head spin. But they're your friend when it comes to this. They're experts in their field. And so you can work with them to make sure that you get the right impeller for your application to minimize the damage that you can do to your tube and to your beer.
That was Aaron Golston here on the Master Brewers Podcast. Be sure to check the show notes for links, including a link to Aaron's 2021 Master Brewers Technical Quarterly paper, as well as the presentation Aaron gave to District Eastern Canada last year. Are you enjoying the Master Brewers Podcast? Let me tell you about a simple way you can help us keep making more. Take a minute to thank our sponsors. There's no way we could produce this show without generous support from sponsors like Hopsteiner, Proximity Malt, BSG, Berkeley Yeast, and the Lupulin Exchange. So please, let them know you heard their message on the Master Brewers Podcast and that you appreciate their support.